May it please the Court. I'm Carolyn Cassidy Trimble, appearing for Appellant Lawrence Burton. Lawrence Burton was born April 2, 1939, and was 56 years old on July 5, 1995, his last date worked. He has an eighth grade education and has been unable to obtain his GED despite several years of studying. He had an excellent work record prior to 1995, when his combined mental and physical impairments forced him to cease working at the only job he had done for most of his work life, painting. Burton initially did not know what was causing his problems, and neither did his treating doctors. His psychiatrist's diagnosis of panic disorder and agoraphobia did not account for all of his symptoms. Eventually, he got a caseworker who was able to help him receive the medical evaluations and treatments he needed, but not until after his initial disability hearing and denial. The appeals counsel refused to consider that evidence, saying that it did not relate to the time period in question. That position of the commissioner was not substantially justified.
Let me just ask you this. How could we say that the agency's position was not substantially justified when it turns out that Mr. Burton suffered from a different impairment than he originally claimed?
Mr. Burton, on his request for reconsideration and his request for a hearing before the administrative law judge and at his hearing, alleged numerous physical impairments. He said he was unable to bend. He said he was unsteady on his feet.
Has he ever been found to be disabled by arthritis?
I think arthritis was a diagnosis that the doctors had. It is a diagnosis that the second administrative law judge did, in fact, pick up. I think it's one of the terms that you can use for what was wrong with his spine. He was found to be disabled because of the combination of medical or physical and mental impairments.
Has he ever been found to be disabled by reason of arthritis? I mean, it really is a yes or no, I think.
I don't know that. No, I don't believe by reason of arthritis alone.
What objective evidence has he ever submitted to support his theory?
To the appeals counsel, he submitted evidence of an MRI. He submitted evidence. Well, the
talking about the time of the first hearing.
At the time of the first hearing, he was not able to afford a doctor, and he did not, in fact, go to a doctor.
I didn't ask
other
that.
Than a psychiatrist.
I said, what objective evidence did he present? The answer is either or no.
I'm sorry. What objective evidence did he...
Did he present at the first hearing?
At the first hearing, he presented evidence from his treating psychiatrist, Dr. Yang. Dr. Yang is an MD and did not refer him to any other doctors. Most of the evidence that he presented testimony himself of his difficulties. He didn't
That's
know
not
what
objective
was
evidence, though.
That is not.
That's
he
what
did
I
not.
Asked.
Right. And the administrative law judge could have sent him off for numerous consultative exams. Administrative law judges do that frequently. But the judge simply decided that he would disregard Mr. Burton's complaints of physical impairments and decide that the only disabling impairments were probably mental. That was indeed what Mr. Burton put on his own initial application. This is not an educated person. He did not receive the support from the system that the system guarantees it will give. The actual cause of much of Burton's difficulty in walking, balancing, and grasping was not noted until an MRI was taken of his cervical spine on August 27, 1997. At that point, there was no longer any question regarding the primary cause of his physical ailments.
How do we factor in the fact that the ALJ had relied on that report that followed the consultative physical examination that indicated that Mr. Burton did not have severe limitations that would relate to
his range of motion or strength.
Doctors,
and that, you know, that he was able to drive, fish, play the guitar.
Right. I don't believe that his... Well, Dr. Souter's exam, when initially received, was clearly Dr. Souter's report of what Mr. Burton was able to do in the examining room was different from Mr. Burton's version. Therefore, we requested a subpoena from the administrative law judge so that we could ask Dr. Souter whether this was in fact the same person that he examined. The administrative law judge refused.
Is it your position that Mr. Burton had an absolute right to subpoena the doctor who provided that examination?
Yes.
That's your position?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that this court has held
that...
Are
you saying that he's required to do so?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe
that
all of the note...
The answer actually is no.
Yes.
And that's Burton versus Apfel. So you might want to take a look at that. 173 F3rd.
All right. I believe that many of the other cases do not involve an examining doctor. When the request for subpoena came, I believe that it was for one of the non-treating, non-examining opinions. And in this case, it was an examining doctor. And I believe that in my brief, I cited the cases that, including one by this court, indicating that, in fact, there is a right to a subpoena. Moreover, the law provides, even if Mr. Burton were somehow not allowed or were not entitled to question the evidence that was presented against him through a subpoena, the Appeals Council is mandated to take a look at all of the evidence.
How do you think issuing the subpoena would have affected the outcome in any event?
Since that's speculative, I think that Dr. Souter, faced with Mr. Burton and cross-examined as to whether Mr. Burton in fact walked easily when he hadn't walked easily for years, and in fact climbed easily onto the examining table when he hadn't done anything like that for years, might have had to say perhaps he made a mistake. And had Mr. Burton been found capable of doing only light work, which is lifting 10 pounds, standing and walking for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day, he would have been found disabled according to the grids, which are the rules that the administrative law judge must find in determining disability. I have reserved time for rebuttal, and I see that it is the end of my time.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kurt Marseille appearing on behalf of the Commissioner. Your Honors, the only issue in this case is whether the District Court abused its discretion in denying the appellant's EJIA request. The government asserts that the District Court properly denied that request because the government's position was substantially justified at all stages of the appellant's claim. At the ALJ level, as this Court alluded to, there simply was no objective medical evidence supporting his complaints of physical impairments.
In part, Mr. Burton met the standard for total disability based on his panic disorder. Was there any new evidence presented on that claim, or did the second ALJ simply come to a different conclusion based on the same evidence?
Based on my reading of the second ALJ's decision, the panic disorder had little or anything to do with his disability. Instead, the second ALJ considered evidence that the first ALJ hadn't considered, that the Appeals Council hadn't considered, and in fact that the District Court didn't even get a chance to look at. The second ALJ considered evidence from a 1994 treatment notes from the appellant's chiropractor, and that weighed heavily on the second ALJ's decision to find that the appellant was limited to light work. In addition to the chiropractic notes, the second ALJ also had state agency physicians' opinions indicating that the appellant was limited to light work. So, indeed, there was a significant amount of additional evidence not considered by any adjudicating body prior to the second ALJ's decision, which impacted and factored into that decision. With respect to the evidence, after the first ALJ properly denied the claim because of the lack of objective evidence, the appellant submitted additional evidence to the Appeals Council, and it was first at that point that he really claimed a neck impairment. Up to that point, he claimed he had a back impairment, he had problems with his legs. It wasn't up until that evidence suggested a neck impairment that he really changed his claim. And significantly, the Appeals Council, when confronted with that additional evidence, reasonably found that it wasn't relevant to the time period at issue or encompassed by the ALJ's decision. The ALJ decided the case on March 25, 1997, and virtually all of the evidence related to the appellant's physical condition submitted to the Appeals Council was evidence that postdated that time period. The evidence itself did not purport to relate back to the time period at issue. And perhaps the best example of the reasonableness of the Appeals Council decision was the medical expert's testimony at the second ALJ hearing that, in fact, the record did not support greater than light limitations prior to 1997. So in addition to the evidence itself not specifically relating back, there is objective evidence by a medical expert that that evidence, in fact, did not invade the time period. Dissatisfied with the Appeals Council determination, the appellant appealed to the district court and it submitted yet additional evidence. At that point, the commissioner reasonably looked at the evidence and said, perhaps this would warrant a second look. The commissioner agreed with the appellant. They joined together in a sentence 6 remand. Clearly, that can't be unreasonable. Clearly, a joint motion with the appellant, which the appellant requested, can't be an unreasonable litigation position. Thus, the commissioner was substantially justified during the administrative process as well as during the litigation phase. And again, the evidence on remand was significantly different than the evidence the commissioner or the first ALJ was confronted with, and it was significantly different than the evidence the Appeals Council was confronted with. Based on a fair reading of the entire proceedings here, both pre and during the litigation phase, the commissioner has demonstrated that his position was substantially justified. We would ask that this court affirm the district court's finding that the commissioner was substantially justified and therefore properly denied the appellant's EJIA request.
Thank you, counsel.
The second administrative law judge had to make a slightly different decision than the first administrative law judge did. He had to decide not only that Mr. Burton was disabled as of July 5, 1995, he had to decide that he was still disabled in March of 2001, 6 years later. Therefore, of course, the second administrative law judge had to look at the continuing treatment. Nevertheless, the information, the medical evidence that was submitted to the district court on which the remand was based was the same evidence that was submitted to the Appeals Council. The only additional evidence that was submitted to the district court was a functional capacity evaluation performed by a physical therapist. This cannot be medical evidence in the terms of Social Security. 20 CFR 404.1513 specifies that acceptable medical sources are licensed physicians, licensed osteopaths, licensed or certified psychologists, and licensed optometrists. If the evidence were a stack of bricks, the report from the physical therapist and the later report from the chiropractor could be nothing more than the mortar that was used to link the bricks together. Therefore, we are asking this court to find that the position, or that the government's position, was not substantially justified, and that plaintiff is entitled to attorney's fees under EJIA.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case on advisement. Thank you as well, and proceed to case number 3.